Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The natural gas boom begs the question, what do you do with the waste? A Virginia Learning Center focuses on good water stewardship.
So it opens up every sense for a child instead of sitting in a classroom.
3D printers help Marshall University students learn human evolution.
For a skull like this, it will probably take about at least 2 to 3 hours to print this off.
And what is that pink teepee-shaped building in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, anyway?
It was our playhouse for years and years. The kids played in it and got out of the rain in it and even did some bad things in it.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The natural gas boom continues to sound in places like the northern gas fields of West Virginia. State lawmakers are working on ways to take maximum advantage of the economic benefits, but they're also grappling with the excess of waste products created in the extraction process. As West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports, legislators recently learned more about this issue from West Virginia University experts.
The Horizontal Well Act of 2011 allocated funding to study the impacts of horizontal drilling. Legislators reached out to West Virginia University's Water Research Institute. Director Paul Zimkevich studied both solid and liquid waste produced from horizontal wells. Horizontal wells produce two kinds of wastewater, flowback and what's referred to as produced water. Zimkevich explains, once a well is fracked, meaning once operators take 5 million gallons of water mixed with sand and additives and blast it deep into this hard, black, non-porous rock called Marcellus Shale, the pressure is then released. And the first thing that happens is a regurgitation of some of that fluid. Zimkevich explains that the longer the fracking fluid mingles with the rock formation, the more stuff from that formation flows back out with the fluid. Zimkevich says in some cases, this briny water produced a concentration of about 250,000 milligrams per liter of dissolved solids, which he explains is essentially 25% solid. Where does it go from there? Well, Zimkevich says about 25% of that fluid is pumped back into deep wells classified as injection waste disposal wells. 75% of the flowback is being recycled, but still has to be processed. Solids like clays, metals, and rocks are filtered and precipitated out, leaving cakes behind. These cakes are then dumped into solid waste landfills. The same place that the mud and rock produced during the drilling process is dumped. So now we're in the realm of solid waste. Here's where it gets a little muddy. Under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, or RCRA, hazardous waste is differentiated from industrial solid waste based on tests that determine chemical properties. Now, interestingly, federal law exempts drilling waste from regulation as hazardous waste. But fortunately, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection is proceeding with some caution anyway. Scott Mandarola, director of the DEP's Division of Water and Waste Management, explains horizontal well operators were just sort of spreading this waste on properties or dumping it, burying it, whatever, wherever. The Horizontal Well Control Act of 2011 specified that instead the waste should be disposed of in appropriate landfills. So municipal landfills started accepting the waste. And we're talking about a lot of waste. So DEP Cabinet Secretary Randy Huffman sent a memo out to solid waste landfill operators in July of last year saying they could continue to accept the waste if they took one of two actions: apply to expand their operation or construct separate cells specifically for these waste products. Bill Hughes is the chairman of the Wetzel County Solid Waste Authority.
Wetzel County, which is legally permitted for up to 9,999 tons, let's round it off to 10 times 12, 120,000 tons per year. Our landfill last year took in about 330,000 tons. Of that, about a quarter million tons was drill waste, drill cuttings.
Mandarola says the landfill there in Wetzel County, one of the most heavily drilled counties in the state, has seen one of the largest influxes of waste because of its proximity to so many well sites. This concerns residents for reasons such as the amount of space available in landfills, and also because there's still very little known about the chemical characterization of the waste. Enter Paul Zimkevich, who, again, was tasked with looking specifically into exactly that. Zimkevich did look at drilling muds, but he explains that a combination of bad luck, low response times from companies and the DEP, bad weather, and an aggressive time frame to report these results contributed to the lack of access to drilling samples from the actual rock formation where Marcellus gas exists, the shale. So unfortunately, it's still something of a mystery. Zimkevich is calling for an additional study to further test these solid waste streams. Zimkevich's other recommendations include what he calls common sense measures, like proper containment of drill sites to guard against spills, and thorough inspection and enforcement by well-trained authorities. He also suggests tracking liquid wastes to have a clear knowledge of exactly where they end up. Zimkevich and other experts say it's hard to predict the future of oil and gas development, but everyone seems certain that significantly more drilling is the most likely scenario, and therefore more insight into the science and practices of the industry is the best course of action to safeguard not only communities, but also employees and first responders. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
A European method for converting garbage to fuel is coming to West Virginia. The Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority has signed an agreement to lease part of its property to a company to build a mixed waste resource recovery facility. Chairman Clint Hogben says the Italian company Ensorga plans to build a $19 million facility there.
Ensorga has a patented technology where waste that's picked up at the curb and normally would be taken to the landfill is redirected to a building, and that building contains millions of dollars worth of mechanical equipment that's computerized, and that equipment will sort and process that waste into a product that can be used as a coal substitute or can be burnt with coal to create BTUs.
Hogman says the facility will separate recyclables and items that won't generate high BTUs, things like glass bottles and aluminum cans.
What's left or after, you know, those items are pulled out are the items that are cleaned, dried, and shredded and ready to be used as a substitute to coal.
Coal is sort of a polluting kind of thing to burn. How does this stuff stack up to that?
That's a great question. Instorga was able to show us test results that demonstrated that compared to coal, this material was either lower or equal in pollutants of the hazardous constituents that coal produces.
Hogben hopes the new facility will demonstrate it's possible to find new ways to deal with garbage and everything doesn't have to go to the landfill. A Kentucky utility is looking to evaluate the feasibility of generating electricity through the power of the sun. Kentucky Utilities is asking for State Public Service Commission approval to build a solar facility at the Brown Generating Station in Mercer County. KU spokesman Cliff Feltham says the utility is also moving to combined natural gas to fuel electricity generation.
The combined cycle natural gas units are going to be more environmentally friendly than the coal-fired units, and we anticipate that the solar units will be even more environmentally friendly than the natural gas units. So it's a step toward being even more environmental friendly for our company.
Feltham says 96% of KU's energy is now produced at coal-fired plants. He doesn't foresee solar becoming a major factor in producing electricity in the near future. He says he envisions the solar plant up and running by the end of 2016. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A U.S. Senate subcommittee will hear testimony on the West Virginia chemical spill in Washington next week. The Committee on Environment and Public Works, Water and Wildlife Subcommittee will convene Tuesday on the spill that left 300,000 people without clean water for days. Scheduled to testify are West Virginia Secretary of State Natalie Tennant, West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Randy Huffman, Natural Resources Defense Council official Eric Olson, and Putnam Public Service District General Manager Michael McNulty, among others. Meanwhile, the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee will hold its counterpart hearing in Charleston on February 10th. That committee includes two West Virginia members, Congressman Nick Rahal and Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito. 3 weeks after that chemical used to clean coal contaminated drinking water in nine counties surrounding Charleston, state officials are saying, based on federal guidelines, the water is safe to use. But as NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports, not everyone believes this assessment.
One of those specialists is the top doctor who runs the largest public health department in West Virginia. Rahul Gupta is director of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department. He's in charge of protecting 250,000 people whose water was affected by the spill. And I asked him, do you feel confident that federal health officials know what levels of these chemicals are safe or not?
I think there's no way to know what the safe levels of the chemical are at this point.
In fact, Gupta says his own family doesn't trust the water supply, no matter what federal and state officials say. His wife is a physician, like he is. They have two teenage sons, and Gupta says the water in their home still has that chemical smell of licorice.
They have decided not to drink the water at this time. I have personally tried to drink the water. this smell just keeps me, prevents me from drinking the water, unfortunately.
I've been talking with public health specialists in government, in universities, in public interest groups, and they say here we are, more than 3 weeks since the chemicals poured into the drinking water, and still there are more troubling questions than answers about whether the spill might affect public health, not to mention the fact that no one knows for sure how much chemicals really spilled and exactly which chemicals spilled. The company first said it was 5,000 gallons of MCHM. Then they said, no, more like 7,500 gallons. Now they're saying, well, probably more like 10,000 gallons. Plus, it turns out another chemical leaked too, called PPH.
It feels a bit like a Keystone Cops episode, where one crazy thing is followed by another.
Richard Dennison is a toxicologist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He's served on advisory boards for the federal government and for the chemicals industry. And Dennison says, consider this. Just one day after the spill, officials at the National Centers for Disease Control proclaimed that the water was safe. Well, they didn't exactly call the water safe. Vikas Kapil is the CDC's chief medical officer in charge of environmental health. He said at one part per million of MCHM,
we believe that at exposures below that level, we would not expect any adverse health effects.
So Dennison, another health specialist, asked the CDC, how do you come up with that number, one part per million? The CDC took days to answer, but they finally said, we based it on a rat study done back in 1990 at Eastman Kodak.
I was really shocked.
Because Dennison says that study does not suggest that one part per million is safe. And when Lynn Goldman heard the news, she was also dismayed.
That study wouldn't have been enough to come up with a definitive number that would say one part per million, that's a safe number.
Goldman is dean of public health at George Washington University. She used to run the toxic chemicals division at EPA. Goldman says Eastman's study was a good step toward trying to understand how MCHM affects people. But she says Eastman's study is seriously limited. The study looked only at how MCHM might affect adults, in this case by testing it on grown rats. The researchers did not consider how the chemical might affect fetuses or newborns. And Goldman says history shows that lots of chemicals don't hurt adults, but they wreak havoc on the young. So today, if you were living in West Virginia, would you use the water?
I think if I could still smell or taste the substance in the water, I wouldn't use the water.
The CDC's website does say, quote, few studies on this specialized chemical exist, unquote. The CDC's Kapil puts it like this.
There are many circumstances in which we would, of course, like to have more information about human toxicologic evaluations, additional animal studies, and we simply don't have that kind of data available.
The CDC website adds, if you have any concerns, please consult your doctor. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Meanwhile, a body of water in north-central West Virginia that was polluted 4 years ago by mine discharge, leading to a massive fish kill, is now doing much better. West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio has more.
Almost 5 years ago, a golden algae bloom killed just about everything in the stream Dunkard Creek, which meanders through West Virginia and southwestern Pennsylvania. Among the victims were muskies and bass, but more importantly, perhaps, the creek's mussel population. Fisheries biologist Frank Jernasek with the DNR says it's going to take decades and decades for those to come back.
We have stocked 5 species of mussels in the last 2 years. It'll be a number of years before we can assess how successful they will be because their reproduction is relatively slow. And, of course, the mussels have a very unique reproductive cycle.
But the good news is that the creek is restoring itself. In fact, it's happening at a much faster pace than even Jernasek estimated. Jernasek says 35 total species were wiped out in the kill. Almost that many various species are back.
So we've seen the muskies, smallmouth recover and reproduce. The muskies have returned in fairly good numbers, and we haven't made a decision yet whether we will stock muskies in the next year or two. We may not have to. Although our original program for muskies on the river around Dunkard was to stock them every 2 or 3 years.
The muskies are a key element to the creek because it was a main attraction for local fishermen, according to Jernasek. He says fishing enthusiasts aren't using this stream as much as they were before, but he expects that to change since the population is coming back.
Well, muskies are a top predator, just like the smallmouth bass. They are also a very desirable sport fish. So they are a fish that the public can utilize. The stream has recovered remarkably well and should be a destination now for muskie and smallmouth fishermen. And Dunkard Creek was one of the, it was certainly in the top 15 or 20 of all of the muskie streams that we stock in West Virginia.
However, Jernasek says the DNR isn't seeing any new species enter Dunkard Creek. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
Water stewardship is the focus of education in St. Paul, Virginia, at the Wetlands Estanoa Learning Center. Here, high school students are steeped every day in a rich, interactive learning environment through a long-running, student-driven project. As WMMT's Parker Hobson reports, the center is both an outdoor classroom and a functioning wetland that helps maintain clean water in the Clinch River watershed, one of the most biodiverse river systems in North America.
Hey, Peyton.
Yes.
Say a few words, just so he
can hear you. A few
words. Oh, no. Say more than a few words.
More than a few words.
And much more.
Welcome to Estanoa.
Terry Vinsel's environmental education class is unlike any other at Castlewood High School in Wise County, Virginia. For one, it doesn't even happen in Castlewood, but in the nearby town of St. Paul. For another, it takes place at a wetland for 4 days out of every week. On the day we visited, Terry was getting the class ready for an open house day with their parents.
Come on, talk to me. What do you really like about this project?
How so hands-on.
Okay, at this point, that's where you need to say. Why do you like it being hands-on?
It gives you a chance to interact with the environment, get to know more about it.
Get out of the classroom.
Bingo. Get out of that classroom. We're communicating what you guys know the best about this project to the people you love, and that's what it's all about. Getting your parents into this building and letting you shine, letting you look good.
The students were preparing to welcome their parents to the Wetlands Estanoa Outdoor Learning Center, an indoor and outdoor classroom consisting of both a functioning wetland and a small classroom building that overlooks it. Both the building and the wetland itself are the result of a unique, long-running student project that has been looking after and learning from the property since 1999. Teacher Terry Vinsel helps oversee the project, and she told me that before it got going, the area used to look quite different.
Wetlands Estanoa started out as a wet cornfield, and somewhere in the early 1900s, John Hillman's sons dammed up that wet cornfield, and a lake developed. By the 20s and 30s, it was a social focus, baptismal place, picnic place, fishing place. And in the early 1950s, the town built their first municipal pool a block and a half away. Well, that little pond, that little lake Estanoa, fell into disuse because the kids had all gone to the concrete swimming hole. And the locals threw trash in it. It had brush, it had everything. And in 1999, a student named Stevie Sabo chose Estanoa as a project. He wanted to turn it back into a pristine lake.
For his project, Stevie compiled a report on the lake's history and its state of disrepair in hopes of one day seeing it cleaned up. The next year, another student, Nikki Buffalo, discovered the lake was actually a wetland. And from there, a long line of Terry's students has worked to restore and maintain the property by cleaning out trash and debris, undertaking improvement projects like building a floating dock and a walking trail, and even managing to get Estanoa officially certified as a wetland by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. As Terry told me, cleaning and restoring the wetland has done a great deal of good for the local watershed, especially the nearby Clinch River, one of the most biodiverse river systems in North America.
In the mountains particularly, wetlands are usually in low spots. So as water comes down, it sits in Estanoa. The particulate matter, the dirt, the oil, the whatever, settles into Estanoa, and the water then percolates to the Clinch River cleaner and a lot healthier than if it ran straight off from the land into the river. So she definitely is a liver for the river.
But the project has not just improved water quality. especially since the Learning Center was built on-site in 2005. Estanoa has served as a rich, interactive outdoor classroom for the students who pass through Terry's class each year, which is now also a dual enrollment course with a local college. Terry's students have undertaken studies of endangered mussels with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. They've monitored water quality for NASA, and they've engaged in countless other projects. Terry told me that learning outside like this is a powerful force for students.
It opens up the possibilities to kids about all the senses. You feel the rain, you feel the wind, but you also hear that bird, and you also see the leaves falling or whatever it is. So it opens up every sense for a child instead of sitting in a classroom. And if a teacher is in a lecture situation, all the kid does is hear the lecture. Or if the teacher is a worksheet teacher, then all that kid knows is pushing that pencil. And it cuts down, it shuts down some of the ability to learn with kids. I think kids learn outside. I really do. Much quicker.
Because of the unique environment and learning opportunities there, Terry said that coming to Estanoa has had a wide range of positive effects on her students.
They come to school more. They come to school more because they look forward to the last class of the day. And they've told me over and over again, if we've had a horrible day, and they say a little bit different, but if we have a horrible day, we always think toward last period because we're coming to Estanoa. And I see the biggest difference in kids once they get down here. It's like the feathers smooth down, the voices calm down. They're not near as irritable. They're more understanding. We really do a disservice to kids keeping them inside a building.
We're not supposed to be stuck inside all day.
Why not?
Because we're humans. We're not supposed to be inside all day. In our genes, we're not supposed to be inside beings.
Plus, we're inside
all day. We have been outside beings for, like, ever. Everything has been more inside-based because people are getting more...
technical.
Yeah, technical. They're getting more girlish, and they're all cold and everything. Sorry, women.
Second benefit, it shows them occupations that they can go into. I've got one girl that was sitting right in the middle of the group. She hates to get dirty. But she's the best PR person. She does the articles for the newspaper. She does the brochures. She does the newsletters. Now, she doesn't want to get dirty, but she loves that part of it. Then we've got the guy that just wants to haul gravel. And he was really good at the site map. When he drew his site map, everything was in place, and it was just, I mean, he was real meticulous. He put the bridges in. He put a dog walking across the bridge. I mean, yeah, really, really good. So as far as the benefit for the kids, it shows them what they can do in the future.
I want to do Estanoa in the past and the name of Estanoa.
So you want to do the history and the name. Can somebody be secretary and write Jared down as Estanoa means land of blue waters and the history in the past? You want to do project funding. But you also see kids start getting possessive. Because if they see trash that's down, they're offended because somebody's thrown trash down. And you start seeing them walk across campus and picking up trash when normally they would have walked away around it or away from it or whatever. So I think increasing the awareness of the environment tremendously.
Even though Terry hopes to retire soon from teaching a full course load, she has no plans to stop teaching the environmental education course at Estanoa. So for the foreseeable future, it seems safe to predict that Wetlands Estanoa will help maintain water quality in the Clinch River Valley and will continue to be a powerful tool for new generations of students at Castlewood High School to learn about environmental issues and about themselves. Terry hopes to keep learning right along with them.
Well, I don't want to quit. You know, I don't want to quit. I enjoy this. It doesn't show at all, does it?
Not hardly.
There are three forms of education. One is, I will tell you. Most education is done that way. I will show you. Some teachers are good at showing and designing. And then there's a pilgrimage form of education, and this is pilgrimage. You know, I'm just one of a team.
A little bit older.
A lot older. This maybe a little bit wiser. But I'm part of a team, and the kids teach me as much as I could ever teach them. We learn together.
They're going to be sitting in the middle of you, and you're going to speak, and mom's just going to bubble over. And then somebody else is going to speak, and their mom's going to bubble over. And they want to know what you've been doing down here. I mean, for years and years, they have heard, he won't sit in his seat. He won't pay attention to me. But you need to talk about why you do down here. You know, what's so special about this project? I love you. Have a good weekend. Good luck tonight, Dakota.
Thank you.
I will see you guys.
For more information about this project, you can visit wetlandsestonoa.org, and Estonoa is spelled Estonoa. Reporting for WMMT and with Rich Kirby, I'm Parker Hobson.
Essayist Colleen Anderson lives in Charleston, West Virginia, and is one of many dealing with the chemical leak that tainted drinking water there. While she, too, is outraged, she can't help but find some humor in the situation. With the help of her co-writer and accompanist, George Castell, Anderson came up with a new song the city might want to consider in its next tourism campaign.
Charleston, the town inimical, hip, historic, cool and chemical. Yes, there's sludge and it could spill. So if you're looking for a thrill, it's Charleston, we're excellent-y. Whole place smells like good and plenty. You'll get accustomed to the stink here. Just don't shower, eat or drink here. Flush your pipes and flush your hoses. Close your eyes and hold your noses. Flush your drain and flush your sink. Now fill your glass, let's have a drink in Charleston. Charleston's a real big time. Come on in, the water's fine. It's a dandy place for a holiday. Unless you work for the EPA, methyl cyclohexane methanol may not even kill us after all. But downstream they're going batty. It's on its way to Cincinnati from Charleston. There's no place hotter. Better bring some bottled water. Climb our mountains if you care to. Y'all come back now if you dare to Charleston. It's Charleston.
That's essayist Colleen Anderson. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Weather has wreaked havoc on the school schedule this year all across Appalachia. For example, several times in January, all of West Virginia's 55 counties were forced to close their schools. In some cases, they won't be able to meet the goal of giving 180 days of classroom instruction. West Virginia State School Superintendent Jim Ferris says, for many counties, this is an unusual school year.
In Kanawha Valley, with the water issues, this is way past normal. They make all their days up easily with days to spare. This year, because of the water crisis, they're not going to be able to do that.
Ferris says it is unusual to have weather that impacts the entire state the way it has this year, forcing counties to cancel school because of snow and extremely frigid temperatures.
You know, you kind of have a perfect I hate to use this word, but a perfect storm in this matter, in that you had snow in some areas, significant levels of snow, and you didn't have any melting conditions whatsoever. So everything either had to be pushed or salted away.
Many states, including Kentucky, are implementing what's called Common Core Education Standards, which are meant to standardize what students are learning in core subjects across state lines. Kentucky Public Radio's John Knoll has more.
Support for the Common Core in Kentucky is mixed. In the state house, a bill that would prohibit its implementation is currently in the Standing Committee on Education. Western Kentucky Republicans Ben Wade and Myron Dossett are sponsoring the bill that would require the state board to recommend new content standards to schools after consultation with the Council on Post-Secondary Education. But the president of the Kentucky Education Association says Common Core is working. Stephanie Winkler.
Teachers were clamoring for standards that made sense. And the Kentucky Common Core academic standards do make sense. The standards are smaller. They're able to get kids to master things, so when they go on to the next level, they're more prepared.
Winkler says feedback from Commonwealth superintendents and teachers is largely positive. Kentucky Association of Professional Educators Executive Director Ruth Green says she has heard more mixed feedback, with some educators saying the standards aren't strong enough and do not constitute a complete curriculum. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm John Knoll.
Students at Marshall University are getting lessons in human evolution through the use of a 3D printer. West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis reports on how biological anthropologist Paul Constantino is using the device in his classes.
Constantino and the department purchased the high-tech 3D printer to help with teaching about specimens that are so old they wouldn't usually be able to touch them. Using the printer, he's able to give his students in human anatomy courses a chance to handle replicas of specimens they are studying. The machine is so new to the department, they're not sure what all they can do with it. Constantino says it just makes sense as the next step in learning for students.
A lot of times you have three-dimensional data on the computer, and you can see it on the computer, but it's still really hard to visualize how shape changes, how two skulls, for instance, these two species may differ from one another. We can actually print them off here and hold them in our hands, and it's much more intuitive not only for us as researchers, but also for students to be able to see what are the differences.
The printer creates a model that fits the exact specifications of whatever is inputted into the system. Constantino says it's a process that doesn't take long and can make the classroom experience that much easier for students to see parts of the anatomy.
It prints off about 20 millimeters per hour, so for a skull like this, it will probably take about at least 2 to 3 hours to print this off. And then once it's printed, there's a little post-printing modification we have to do. We have to blow off the excess powder, and then we have to put an epoxy resin on top of it just to harden it up and make sure it's durable. So that takes maybe an extra hour on top of that. So overall, probably about 3 to 4 hours.
The anthropologist sees no limit to how the technology could be used all over campus, such as others in the science fields, but also others throughout the university for a hands-on experience.
We feel like that there are teachers all over the university that could potentially benefit from it. We envision people that work on the molecular scale being able to print off scaled-up versions of their molecules and show them to their students so that rather than trying to picture what this thing looks like in their head, they can actually see in their hands a model of what this molecule might look like.
He says professors will quickly see that's one of the many things about the future of education that's becoming much more interactive.
I think it's certainly going to be a tool that becomes much more widely used than it is now. I mean, even since we bought this, technology's been evolving. So now they have ones that can print in metal, ones that can print in plastic. It's becoming cheaper. So I think, you know, right now it's not hugely used, but as it becomes more affordable, I think it's going to really explode, and I think both teaching and research is going to really benefit from it.
Constantino says the next step is to purchase a 3D scanner to complement the printer. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
On January 27th, the Charleston Gazette published an article entitled Remembering Malcolm X on Martin Luther King Day. West Virginia University's chief diversity officer, David Friesen, wrote the article out of frustration that he felt as a person of color seeing how the African American community is treated, even when it comes to planning things like the Martin Luther King Day ceremony. As we begin Black History Month, Friesen shares his thoughts on these two iconic men of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X.
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was arguably the greatest American of the 20th century. And in fact, in my mind, I believe Dr. King is equal to the founding fathers in importance to the American ideals of freedom and ordered liberty. Nevertheless, during the recent King Day celebration, and acting in my new capacity as a gubernatorial appointment to the West Virginia Martin Luther King Day Commission, my thoughts continually reflected on Malcolm X. You see, Dr. King spoke to our aspirations to be an equal part of the American dream. His emphasis was on making America live up to the ideals of its Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. His focus on Gandhi's principles of nonviolence changed the trajectory of our country and has been a source of strength and inspiration for countless millions of those seeking freedom. We Shall Overcome, the anthem of the movement, was utilized by the oppressed in South Africa's Soweto Township, in Tiananmen Square in China, in North Korea, and during the Arab Spring. Malcolm X, by contrast, was often mischaracterized as one who taught violence and hate. But in reality, Islamic minister Malcolm taught us self-respect and demanded genuine equality for the African-American community. He espoused the futuristic principles of cooperative economics and self-determination, along with the need to have a worldview that linked all oppressed people. You see, Martin forced the issue with entrenched powers regarding our participation in a society that excluded so many from the fullness of the American experience. But Malcolm X attempted to prepare the African-American community by promoting self-respect, to prepare the black community once access was achieved. In other words, Minister Malcolm prepared us internally for the access that Dr. King fought for externally. Near the end of their lives, Malcolm X and Dr. King were actually becoming more alike. For instance, Dr. King was very disillusioned at the time of his death over the depth and depravity of racism in this country. And near the end of his life, Malcolm X realized that many of the negative economic consequences cut across racial boundaries. And he realized that the poor were used as pawns of a racist system that abused their ignorance for political and economic gains. Both men should be remembered for their contribution to the struggle. Yes, during my deliberations with the Martin Luther King Holiday Commission and during the events of the King Day celebration, I was thinking about his importance to the community. And by his, I mean Malcolm X. And remembering Ossie Davis's eloquent eulogy of this great man when he said, "Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood." This was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. However we may have differed with him or with each other about him, his value as a man, let his going from us serve only to bring us together now. Honoring Dr. King on Monday was an honor and a privilege. Reflecting on how Minister Malcolm X would confront our current situation is my continuing challenge.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Along the highway in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, sits a pink 15-foot-high teepee. Shrouded in local mystery, no plaque or sign is in front to explain just what it is, but chances are if you've driven past the thing, it's caught your eye. When Traveling 219 reporters Gibbs Kinderman and Dan Schultz began asking people to explain the history of this roadside wonder, they heard many varying accounts. That the pink cone is between 60 and 90 years old, that throughout its lifetime it's been transported throughout Pocahontas County to at least four different locations and has been used for everything from an ice cream stand, a playhouse for children, and even, despite its cramped quarters, a home for a grown man. More mystery than history, here is what people remember about the pink cone of Pocahontas County.
This is Gibbs Kinderman. I live in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. For 30 years, I've been driving by an amazing structure on US 219 up on Elk Mountain, about 5 miles north of Marlinton. It looks like a teepee, or maybe an upside-down ice cream cone. Always wondered what it was and how it got there.
I remember when the ice cream stand was down there at that station.
Ice cream cone, yeah. It was used for a variety of things. I think they kept some oil in there at one time for the service station.
Was it used as an ice cream stand when you knew about it?
very, very early, but if I remember the most, I used it for oil storage building.
You only do some things once in your life, and you never do them again. I tried to lick the frost off of that railing there at the ice cream cone, and my tongue stuck. And the second mistake I made was jerking loose. I don't know whether the hides ever growed back on my tongue or not.
This is a picture of my sister and I back in 1954. And you can see the little upside-down ice cream cone house right there. And we had it painted white on the bottom and kind of like a beige coming down halfway. My mom got it. She saw it at a filling station, and she thought to herself, that'd be a nice playhouse for the girls. And so she inquired about it, and the man sold it to her and got it moved, and there was our playhouse for years and years. The kids played in it and got out of the rain in it and even did some bad things in it, and such as I had taken some cigarettes from my dad one time. And so my friends all came over, and we snuck a cigarette. And the smoke was coming out the windows, and my mom and them thought the place was on fire. So they come a-running and caught us. But we did have a great time with that. And I had it up until, well, it was still in the yard when I left Marlinton at, I was in junior high. I was in the seventh grade.
Jim Walker, I think, lived out for a little while, not long. Matter of fact, it was the next house up from him. This community of Brownsburg. It was a cutter community at that time.
I remember them living, like you said, the next house below. And I remember they had a garbage truck. And I remember Miss Sally and Mr. Forrest and Ruth, their daughter, and Hazel.
Forrest McChesney was the garbage man of town. He hired the garbage, and somebody had him to move it out of town and take it up there. And he took it up there, and this guy was brother-in-law moved in it. Actually, me and my brother was in this house up here, this teepee. We used to haul wood up here to Forrest McChesney, and this guy lived right beside it in that teepee. He would always come out there and talk to us. He had a brand new Javelin car, American Motor car, Javelin. And this guy would come out and talk to us. And we went in this thing one time. I got to talk to my brother, and he said, you remember, it had a little table and just enough for a bed and a little stand in there, you know. He had a little stovepipe stuck out the window of it. I mean, it was so small he didn't eat in it. You come around a little road between them, and he lived on the other side of the road, and he just walk over there to his brother's house and eat.
Well, I think it was near the 70s or 69, 68. It must have been about the time I got married. I got married in 69, and I remember Dad coming home telling about Henry bought that old teepee down there. And my mother said, well, what in the world's he going to do with that thing?
Well, Uncle Henry, he was known as a drinking person. He went out one day, and he was a little tipsy, and he bought that thing, drug it up there, and I think Aunt Glenna, she wasn't too happy about it, and Grandma, I think, was alive maybe at the time. But after he got it fixed up, it's been a landmark ever since, and I kind of guess he knowed what he was doing, because everybody talks about it. That's all you hear about is the teepee anymore.
I always remember it as the same color it is now, sort of a dull pink. And Greg Griffith, the ones that bought it off of the estate, him and his brother John and Jill. One day we were talking about the teepee, and he said something about moving it or painting it or something, and I looked at him and said, you can't move it. It's a landmark. Everybody stops and looks at this, wants to know what it's all about. He said, well, I need to paint it. I said, well, paint it the same color you did. He says, I don't know how to get that color. And I said, well, why not? And he said, we just took several buckets of paint, threw it all together, and this is the color we came up with.
Oh, yeah, I'm a-doin'.
Well, it looks like there are as many stories about the pink cone as there are people who remember it. But it doesn't really matter who's right. What matters is enjoying its uniqueness and iconic status, as you travel along U.S. 219 in West Virginia.
You just heard from Robert Sharp, Keith Moore, Alice McClure-Rogers, Mike Hefner, Frieda Hefner, and Karen Sharp. This story was produced by the Traveling 219 Project. To see photos of the pink teepee, visit traveling219.com. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thank you.